think what, one of the things I, one of the reasons I chose this, because when I read it, I think John Yanko's point is very good. Like, if you don't see, allow the desire to be seen, you don't open Pandora's box.
Right.
So I think that's what he's kind of pointing to. Like, if you aren't willing to see desire as a Dhamma,
right,
then you aren't going ever to see Dhamma.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, like, I think she's pointing to something pretty profound.
Yeah. No, I hope I didn't sound like I was disagreeing with that when I brought that up.
I don't want to sound like I'm defending it, but it was kind of like didn't read it as being, I read it as having layers.
Yeah.
Being very still.
Totally, yeah.
Talking to many layers.
And we do have to, I mean, open up to that level of activity in the mind and the experience of desire, the experience of aversion, the allowing it. That's the only way to see the truth of suffering. The first noble truth is to actually open up to that process that's apparent and existent. Mm. Absolutely.
And she said it takes courage to do that.
Right.
Grab all of that. And to even just acknowledge it.
Yeah, like that's a good point too. It's so easy. It's so easy to fall in the habit of either completely shutting everything out and pushing away, or completely just indulging and grabbing it. Mm-hmm. But what takes courage, what's difficult, is reflecting with wisdom, knowing what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And the discussion around language and having something be natural, for me, I found the language of something being conditioned. Just like this feeling that I'm experiencing or this craving is conditioned. So for me, that like it walks that razor's edge between like pushing it away and it shouldn't be versus almost a justification. Mm-hmm. Like it's here, therefore it should be here, therefore it's right. Okay.
Right.
So yeah, if something is conditioned, it means that, well, it's here for a reason. It's because I've indulged in this before,
right,
and I've put the conditions for it, and here it is.
Right.
But since it's only conditioned, there's an opportunity to let it release.
And that's where sometimes I think, somebody made the point, I think, you know, the audience is, you know, who you're also directing at, but... You know, there's always this chicken and egg thing of like saying, oh, well, you know, sexual desire is just a natural part of the human condition. So, you know, acting on it is just fine. You know, it's what we should do because we're human beings. You know, it's kind of, you start to cross the line and you get into, well, it's what we should do because it's our natural heritage. And it's, you know, like, not that we shouldn't do it, but just, you know, that the biological and the underlying tendency, you know, are kind of like firmly rooted with each other and support each other within the conditioned realm. And that there is a certain point where, I mean, it's like, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily agree that, you know, sexual desire is because of the need to reproduce, you know, because there's, you know, or even if that's the basis for sexual desire. You know, I kind of tend to think more of the wish to reproduce is more of a manifestation of the underlying tendency that's in the mind towards sensuality. But, you know, I guess that's all pretty debatable. But I think that's a really good point, that it's all part of the conditioned realm. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be acknowledged, seen, experienced, not pushed down, not denied, but fully known to be able to transcend it.
One time this practitioner was asking Ajahn Panyabhava about it. She kept saying, but sexual desire is natural, it's natural. And he's like, so is the Dhamma.
So I also think of it in terms of questions of values.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just like, as monastics, our value system is geared towards what I would say a much longer term. You know, we're looking at a much longer term, where if one indulges in sexual desire and then concocts justifications for that, it's just, that grows out of a shorter term value system.
Mm. And I think that we get caught up as a culture, particularly in judging things, you know, and calling, trying to make a distinction between what's wrong and what's right, you know, and so that people rightfully get, you know, a bit defensive when they say, well, if you're telling me this is wrong, you know, that's, you know, I don't want to believe that. And so it's sort of like trying to really, really drive it into this culture that, you know, just because, you know, something may not lead to your really extreme long-term welfare and benefit and release from samsara, that doesn't mean it's wrong, you know, or bad, or you should judge yourself, or you shouldn't do it, you know. It's just, yeah, it's that different perspective that, you know, there's a resistance to kind of making that leap, I think, and, you know, because there's so much self-blaming and self-judgment in our psychological inheritance in this culture.
Yeah, along those lines, when I expressed to a friend of mine that I was going to come here, I didn't even say anything about, like, you know, what I thought anybody else should do, and he got very defensive and very, like, you know, yeah, he felt extremely threatened by specifically the celibacy part,
right.
You know, because my choosing to be celibate was like in sort of by implication a criticism
of his
not choosing. I can definitely sympathize with Ajahn Chandasiri's language and approach in that sense.
To make it accessible.
Also, just what you were saying is the implications of our culture and our Judeo-Christian, it's really in there deeply, and so there is a need to encourage people to be willing to see that and work with that as it is without judging it. And I think that's what she's pointing to, is just don't, you know, it's like, you know, people are new to something and they take on precepts and they hold them really tightly. And, and so it's kind of like soften up with that a little bit and use the tools.
Yeah, and actually possibly even more so as a message to the monastics than to the lay community, because there's plenty of monastics who take those kinds of precepts on so strongly in their mind. I mean, the precepts are the precepts, they're the break on speech and action, but then tend to carry that same kind of judgment as to this is wrong, and, you know, it's bad when it comes up. You know, the Buddha said desire is, you know, the root cause of suffering, and so therefore it is bad and I shouldn't be experiencing it.
I appreciated the line about the Siddhadara who had never experienced such murderous rage and such degrees of lust until she ended in Sangha. I thought that was fantastic. Because I think, and Lopur Smita talks about similar experiences of the same, just like
these awful states that just come up.
Yeah, and I think when it happens, it's so easy to be like, okay, something's definitely wrong here.
Or dismiss it with some sort of, you know, summary statement of Dhamma that kind of, you know, dismisses it as an actual experience.
Mm. You said something a couple of years ago, one of the Anagarikas at the midnight tea was asking about how to work with lust when it arises, and you didn't give one, because it's not always, you have to sort of approach it from different angles, and what you told him was that if the lust is so overwhelming, well, you need to do something to sort of temper it down. You can't, that wouldn't be the time to investigate it,
right?
You would need to do some asubha practice and so forth. But then if it is calm enough that you can look at it, you should, because obviously you're going to have to investigate it and see the not-self aspect, the anicca dukkha anatta aspect at some point as well. And I think that's applicable to what we're talking about here.
Mm.
And to Ryan's question, is that there's not one answer. Mm-hmm. There's multiple answers for different times and places,
right,
and where one's at with how to approach these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the whole continuum. Yeah. And that, actually, I think that's a very good summary of what it was that I was trying, the point that I was trying to make. You know, that there is a full range of where one needs to put one's focus, whether it's, you know, in the beginning, especially allowing the impulses to be seen, known, recognized, and not suppressed. And then later on to be investigated to see, you know, where it is that the root cause of suffering really does come from.
I think if they're not looked at too, they'll go underground and
right,
do other kinds of things.
Yeah. And maybe it's my mistake for even kind of bringing it up as an issue, because I don't know, I just like, there's a sort of bit of maybe doctrinal purity that I want to make sure it doesn't just get left at that, you know, that level of yeah, you know, acknowledge it, it's okay, it's part of, you know, it's, and it is, but it can also, you know, be a basis for suffering. So it's a tricky place.